As Nichiren said at the beginning, measurement error is encountered in all areas. So I'm going to talk about how it's encountered in the social sciences, some of the problems we encounter and some of the strategies we take to deal with it. I'll make a few general remarks about the social science approach and a few very brief comparisons with some of the things that go on in the medical, behavioral, physical sciences. Sorry, the medical and physical sciences. And then I'll give a one-slide summary of what I call SEM, structural equation models. By that I mean the full information methods that are used in the social sciences for estimating parameters in systems of latent equations. But that's not the real focus. The focus this afternoon is on limited information methods, where we're essentially looking at single equations. Of the various kinds of limited information methods, I'm going to focus on very naive methods, the two-step methods, and I'll talk about the bias that occurs there, and in some cases, how to avoid it. And then I'll talk about two-stage least squares, or instrumental variables techniques, which we've already heard about. I'll talk about some applications of that in the social sciences. And then I'll finish with 2 minutes on a nonlinear problem, probate regression, where we have latent predictors. Okay, in the social sciences, let's look at the left-hand part of the slide here. Very often the variables that we're looking at, they're unobservable, but they're also hypothetical in a sense. We could talk about intelligence as being hypothetical. That is in contrast with some of the variables that you run into in the physical sciences, medical sciences, example here being calorific intake, for example. There is such a thing as calorific intake, but it's difficult to measure, right? And so we end up looking at self-reports on eating. In the social sciences, in the education, the business sciences, we have variables like this. This came from is it something that was measured in the National Longitudinal Survey of Children and Youth. So that's my connection with longitudinal surveys. Right? They were measuring peer relations. Now, peer relations with kids. We all agree that there is such a thing as a general concept, but, you know, is it fundamentally measurable in this sense? Probably not. So what is done is kids are asked to answer a bunch of questions. And an example here, I have many friends, so the child is asked to answer that question on a scale from 1 to 5, with the responses designed to give as close to an interval level of measurement as possible. And there'll be a number of such questions in a questionnaire. Okay, so we're not short of data. These measures are typically discrete. All right, but these questions are designed so that we can infer something about peer relations. And we can use these questions when we're looking for relationships between peer relations and other variables, be they measured or other latent variables. So we use the terminology latent variables. We've heard that in the physical sciences, medical sciences, we talk about errors in variables, measurement errors, a number of different terms. But they're all related, perhaps not identical. I don't want to say much on this slide. A couple of major references we've already heard. Fuller, mostly linear models. Carroll, Rupert, Stefanski, nonlinear models. There's a lot more conditions here on correlations being zero. I don't want to go into the technicalities of that. We've already heard it. And we've heard that we need conditions, what I call side conditions, on the variances or identifiability restrictions, however you want to call it, if you want to approach this. We've also heard about validation data. That's sometimes available. Paul says it's not even in the physical. Medical science is not often truly available where you can measure some of the variables exactly. Replication data is obviously very important, we've already heard. We don't have validation data for the hypothetical variables, clearly, in the social sciences. We rarely have replication data, but we will have instrumental data, and there are some strong similarities then with what we've already heard about already this afternoon. So let's just jump to how we deal with measurement error, but from now on, I'll just talk about latent variables. I'm writing down here a one-factor model, factor analysis, not always that popular in among some statisticians. So this is a factor model. We have one latent variable, I'll call it xi, and then there's some error, right? And psi and the deltas are, we'll assume, independent. And the model essentially is saying that given psi and some loading, that is going to determine the response to these manifest items. These are the x's, these are what we measure exactly. We use the term manifest items. Okay? We have an identification problem here, and so we either have to set lambda 1 equals 1 or pick the variance. And let's do this so that this item here becomes the one that sets the scale. The point is that even if you do that, you've still got lambda 2 and lambda p, and they're not typically equal to 1. All right? So you don't have replicate data. All right? These measures are not conditionally unbiased for xi, and that turns out to be kind of important. Okay, let's take a single equation model, writing it in fairly straightforward form. Z here stands for an exactly measured variable, which could be in there as well. And this could be one of a whole system. It's becoming popular with some social scientists to write extensive systems of equations like this with latent endogenous and latent exogenous variables, sort of mimicking the econometrician's simultaneous equation systems, okay? Whether you got one equation or more than one equation, you can use the same sort of technology sometimes. The point is you've got these latents, they have to be linked to manifest variables. And I'm going to take the situation where we can identify a set of manifest variables for each of these latents. There are other situations, but I'm going to restrict myself to that. Now, we can do simultaneous estimation of both of the structural and the measurement model parameters. That's what I call the SEM method. By that, I mean full information, maximum likelihood, generalized least squares or other. And this is my one-slide summary of about 50 years of work. Started here in the late 60s, early 70s with Carl Ureskog, defined ML procedures, later generalized least squares, and later lots of other approaches. These full information methods for multi-equation models or for single equation models, they give you consistent parameter estimates and consistent standard error estimates, formally if the y's and the x's are normal. But there's a fair amount of robustness as well. But formally, for non-normal y's and x's, the parameters are consistent, the standard errors are not. Other methods have been developed, asymptotic distribution-free methods that require enormous amounts of data, so they're simply not practical. Pseudo-maximum likelihood and a variety of weighted least squares methods that yield consistent standard errors, but with some loss of efficiency. You know, the sandwich estimator gets involved computing the variance estimates. You can also deal with discrete data directly. Discrete data, what I was going to say was the main issue with skewness and kurtosis, not the discreteness itself, provided you have 5 categories, 6 or 7 categories, you know, that sort of range. But if you want to deal with the discreteness directly, you can. Mutain started that, I think, even earlier than that was Christopherson, I think, in the late 70s, and they modeled the discreteness directly. And there are some complex survey data facilities available, too. So that's all there. Okay, so why are we getting excited about limited information methods? Well, some data analysts use these omnibus methods, but some do not, and there are a lot of reasons why not. In many cases, it's a lack of familiarity. However, many of my colleagues say, there are problems with lack of normality. And those worries are often overdone, actually. But there are some real problems with convergence, particularly for larger models, and sometimes convergence to parameter values are outside the parameter space or on the boundary, depending on how your algorithm is set up. So there are some issues. Okay. So, and there are some other important issues too. Misspecification is one. Okay. If you've got multi-equation systems, there may be some misspecifications in some. You use a simultaneous estimation method, and you've got to propagate those errors into the other equations. So there's an argument for doing one at a time estimation if it's reasonably efficient. So what are these alternative methods? Well, one of them, the simplest, is simply ordinary least squares regression when you've got latent variable scores. We'll talk about how to get those. I will refer to that as the two-step method. Incidentally, when I started my talk, I should have mentioned that this is joint work with Irene Liu, who's sitting over there. I don't think I said that, although it was up on the screen. So this is a very naive method, but the fact is many of my colleagues do it. And some of them know that there's a problem, some of them don't. Instrumental variables methods, that's a very interesting limited information method to be used in this context. And there's a nice paper by Ken Bolan on specific applications in the social sciences, which I'll summarize. There's another method, partial least squares, which some people are interested in. It's a sequential application of the least squares method, but unfortunately it does generate inconsistent parameter estimates, yet it has its strong proponents. I'm going to focus on the two-step and the instrumental variables, the two-stage least squares methods. So let's take a single equation of this type, and just to be simple, I'm going to assume that everything has got zero mean, okay? It's not entirely without loss of generality, but without loss of substantial generality, anyway. And I'm going to assume that the psi i's and eta satisfy measurement models like I showed you, one-factor models. So what we'll do is we'll predict the psi I and eta using the measurement model in some way. Unfortunately, there's no unique way of doing that. Then we'll replace psi I and eta by their predicted values and see what we get. How do you do predict as well? If you've got continuous or you manifest variables that you can approximate as continuous, try linear scores, right? That's one way of doing it. The factor scores. And again, there's no uniqueness. What social scientists call the regression method, these are the weights in the linear combination, and these are related to the loadings this way, where sig theta epsilon is the error variance. That is nothing other than a Bess linear unbiased predictor, or if you're a Bayesian, it's a Bayes, the expected value of the posterior for multivariate normal y's and x's. There's also Bartlett, and there's a few others. Bartlett looks a bit like weighted, well, it is, in fact, weighted least squares with a weight matrix given by the error variances. And, of course, there are corresponding ones for the xi's. The other one that I call it CTT scores. Now, this looks extremely naive. Take the manifest variables, the indicators, and just find their mean. And you think, well, that's totally naive. Well, it isn't, but I call them CTT scores because I think of them as being inspired by psychometric theory. If you read Lord and Novick's book, 1968, there's a huge amount of discussion in there about the psychometric properties of scales of this type. And generally speaking, what people do is they say, well, we're going to use this as a predictor, and we'll use it in our regression analysis, maybe when Cronbach's alpha is suitably large. Now, that's a measure of reliability. If this doesn't suit in the sense that the y's don't have the appropriate psychometric properties, Cronbach's alpha is a lower limit for reliability. So, though it looks naive, it's sort of got a pedigree, okay? And people hark back to that. IRT scores. Item response theory, that's another psychometric measure. Item response theory developed sort of side by side with the classical test theory of psychometrics over 50 years or so. These are non-linear functions of the manifest variables. I got interested in IRT first when Statistics Canada asked me to look at the way they measure, they compute IRT scores in complex surveys. And they were doing it correctly, as it turns out. But then I started wondering, what are they doing? Well, I knew what they were doing. They're putting them on the actual databases for their surveys, and these are being made available to users through the remote data centers. So I was thinking, okay, well, people are going to be using these things in secondary analysis. And I thought, well, these are measured with error. This should be a problem. Irene Liu got involved with me, and we looked at this. It's not just, users with very, very little statistical background who use this kind of technique. It's available there to users of Statistics Canada's research data centers. So what about IRT scores? And what about IRT in general? Item response theory is characterized by a sequence of characteristic functions. For each item, we characterize each item in the scale by a couple of parameters. This is what we call a two-parameter IRT model. So there's a scale parameter and a location parameter, and this now will be the probability of a positive response, and this is sort of a CDF of a normal or a logistic or something. So you can create probability, joint conditional probability, a conditional on eta, and you can use that as a likelihood. Or you can come up with an empirical distribution or an assumed distribution for eta as a sort of a prior and get a posterior, and then of course you can get its expected value if you want what is called the EAP estimator. That's, the psychometricians call that an expected a posteriori estimate of the score, right? But there are also MLEs and weighted likelihood estimates you can get for this likelihood that's defined for a single individual. So instead of a sample size, you have number of items going to infinity. Okay. So there are a lot of different things you can do with IRT. So let's talk about consistency then of this very naive method. Well, we might think it naive anyway. You take the equation, you replace the eta and the xi hat by their predicted values, which means you have to mop up some of the other stuff into the error term. So if you're going to do OLS, you're going to get consistent estimates if U and Xi, their expected value is zero, right? If they're uncorrelated. Well, everybody knows that. None of this is terribly new. It's just a question of putting different things together. Okay, if you have Xi and Zeta, the disturbance term in the equation, independent, which is a standard assumption, and if the Ys and the Xs satisfy trait models, now what I mean by that is, if the Y satisfies a trait model, it means that the individual items, conditional on eta, they're independent, okay, this sort of local independence idea. And similarly for the Xs. So if we got these trait models, and if we use Xi hat being the expected value of this posterior, now that's what Carol Rupert and Stefanski would call a calibration estimator, right? And Paul was talking about doing that and using MCMC and so on and turning that crank. We don't have to use MCMC in this, but it's the same idea. So as I say, it's just these are old ideas. In addition, if we can say that eta hat is conditionally unbiased, then we'll get a consistent estimate for beta. Okay, now let me show you some examples. Let's go to continuous manifest items, and let's take eta hat obtained by Bartlett factor scoring and Xi hat obtained via blockwise regression factor scoring. All that means, blockwise, all it means is you're not estimating Xi hat for the first Xi by itself. You put them all together. So you're taking account of potential correlations between Xi 1, Xi 2, Xi 3, and so on. All right? It turns out Bartlett scores are conditionally unbiased for eta. Regression scores, as we know, are Bayes predictors, and so, we've got, we've essentially satisfied those sufficiency conditions. Now, there's a nice paper in Psychometrica in 2001 where this is, in fact, laid out as a technique for using factor scores in linear regression by Skrondahl and Lake, and they point out that, you get consistent parameter estimates and so on. The proof is rather long, a little involved, and really here it's kind of a two-liner. when you use some of the facts that are really sort of lying around, you know. So as I say, it's a question of assembling known facts. Let's take simple regression for a moment, and let's talk about exact on latent. Why exact? Well, you know, because if it's exactly measured, it's conditionally unbiased by default, right? And we'll take a single xi, discrete x, and we're going to obtain xi hat via this EAP scoring of item response theory. Well, that automatically satisfies the sufficiency conditions, right? And there you are. There's a Monte Carlo study, a little Monte Carlo study. We take the parameters here so that the coefficients of determination in the structural model are 1/2, and the CDs for each of the measurement models, each of the measurement equations are 1/2, which is not unrealistic, okay? And there's just an illustration that the biases are very small. But you don't get away from biases in your estimate of the CD. Go to the multiple case, all right? And so what we want to do then is to get what I call multivariate EAP scoring, or you could use the word blockwise as Scrundle and Lake did, which is this. But that's not typically what's done, at least it's not what's done on the databases that Statistics Canada puts out for the RDCs. Typically what is done is these things are done individually, right? So those estimates don't take account of the potential intercorrelations of the latent variables. You can show that this works if the xi's are independent. That was something that Scrundle and Lake showed for factor scores. So here's, again, a little bit of Monte Carlo stuff. Number of categories in each of these discrete manifest variables, two categories, in other words, binary items, and items on a five-point scale. And here we have the correlation between xi1 and xi2, right? I put these in red. These are the ones I showed you before. When the correlation is zero, the bias is zero, right? When the correlation is non-zero, the bias is non-zero. And it can be quite substantial, right? It's -16%, and the bias in the estimate of the CD is a deal larger. Now, what's in blue here are some numbers that Irene Lou managed to get, well, day before yesterday, I think, she managed to persuade the M Plus program, the new version of that, to provide multivariate EAP scores. And we just got the one so far, and there you are, zero bias, even when these xi's are correlated. So that's just an illustration. I like to see data, not just a bit of theory, because I often do the theory wrong, you know. And when the numbers don't work out, then I go back and fix the theory, you know. So now I'm happy. Okay, a couple of notes. If you put an extra Z in there, then everything gets messed up again, which is not surprising. But, of course, what you've got to do there is get scores like this, right, as Paul has already put that up on the screen earlier this afternoon, right? So that's a full calibration estimator. And actually, we can get that, I think, out of M+. M+, does a lot of its latent variable modeling. If it has exactly measured covariates, it deals with them conditionally anyway. Another note here, when you do IRT, there is no such thing as a conditionally unbiased scoring procedure. Somebody could come up with one, but they haven't yet. If you look at the EAP, the errors, they go 1 upon n, where n is the number of items. But there is a method that was created which has smaller bias. You know, it goes to zero faster than the EAP, little or 1 upon n. So we may then be able to say that if we use WLE for the predictor and we use multivariate EAP for the use this for the response and this for the predictor, then what we've got is a discrete data analog of the Bartlett regression that Scrundle and Lake came up with. We don't know how well that works in practice, but we need to check it out. Now, there are some things I'll say quickly about bias in two-step regression. And I mean, these are results that are very similar to what Gracie showed. Very similar was on page 4 of Fuller's book, right? What we're doing here is using the linear, using the linear scoring, right? And then saying, okay, what does ORS give us? Well, what it gives us is beta times rho squared xi. That's the reliability. That's what Gracie showed. But there's another factor in here. And you look at these factors, and they depend on the weights in the linear scoring algorithm and the loadings in the measurement model, right? And there's no reason why pi eta and pi xi should equal 1. They do in some cases, okay? They'll be conditionally unbiased when they do equal 1, right? But if they're not conditionally unbiased, or if they're not equal, then there will be another source of bias in the naive estimator, okay? And that comes in there by through the nature of the measurement model that we're adopting, is because some of these items are not replicates, okay? We can recover that Skrondahl and Lake result here, because you can show for Bartlett scoring pi eta equals 1, and you can show that for regression scoring pi xi happens to equal the reliability, so everything nicely cancels out. And for Bartlett regression, you recover the true value. Without spending a lot of time here, if you look at the asymptotic variance here, or standard error of the estimated parameter, you see it's also got that bias type parameter in there as well. So if you're looking at test, the test power will depend only on the reliabilities, okay, which is useful, I suppose. And there are results like that for the, you know, again, well known, although I haven't seen that business about those pies being in there before. We don't have equivalent results for the discrete approach, but they do give us a guide if we do some standard errors. You can see here, when I do latent on exact, a lot of practitioners think if you've only got a latent variable or measured with error on your left-hand side, you don't have to worry about it, right? You know, somehow the error goes over on the right-hand side, and that's the end of it. Well, that's not true if you're using CTT scoring. You can see even if you've got 20 items in 5 categories per item, you're still going to have that bias remaining, because it's not coming from the reliability. It's coming from that pi eta, pi xi bias. With the IRT, you can see that it starts to go away with large numbers of items, because the IRT EAP scoring, it's conditionally unbiased asymptotically as the number of items gets large. Okay. Do exact on latent. We know then that the IRT works. We know that for a simple model. CTT still doesn't, can get some large biases there. Okay, and some quick notes here for two-step regression with similar measurement models on both sides. Those bias parameters cancel out more or less. And then there isn't a heck of a lot of difference between CTT and IRT. And the biases due to reliability come in. And of course, this whole business is much more complicated when you have multiple regression, as Gracie pointed out. Things don't cancel in that case, and you've got to take it one case at a time. Anyway, if you want to minimize bias, use long scales and 5 categories per item or more to minimize, if this is the method that you've got to use. Let's look at instrumental variables. How am I doing for time, Lichwin? I forgot. I didn't look at what time I started.
Got 10 minutes.
Better speed up. All right. Take that simple equation and assume that we've got your usual measurement error here. What I'm saying here is I got, for each of the xi's, I've got an x that is conditionally unbiased. And I'm assuming I use the same z. Z, unfortunately, this time is an instrumental variable. Okay, so I'm assuming I got instruments that correlated with xi but uncorrelated with the errors. I will let x hat equal az. A is a matrix of parameters. If I do that and substitute x hat in here, then I complicate my error term. If my u is uncorrelated, my u will be uncorrelated with this and with z if that condition is satisfied, or if a equals this. In other words, if a is a matrix of regression parameters of the x's on the z's. right? So I'm projecting the X's onto the space of the instruments. Okay? And for this to hold, I need full row rank for the A's. Okay? Then I regress Y on Z, and that's going to get me an estimate of this composite parameter, beta transpose A, call it G. And then I can get beta hat from here, plug in the estimate for G, the estimate for A, and I can get an estimate of beta hat. That's two-stage least squares instrumental variables regression, and that gives me consistent parameter estimates. Okay, now, Paul mentioned it's difficult to get instruments. Well, if you're a social scientist, you got them coming out of your ears, you know, as long as you believe your measurement models. Right, we've got a structural model, we got our measurement models, and we're using the first one here to define the Y, the first one here to define, we use the Y to define the eta, the X to define the Xi. And then we're left with all of these variables here, right? We can substitute then for, you know, eta and Xi, and we end up with changing our structural equation into this. Well, all these are manifest variables, and we got this error term, okay? But if you check it out, you find that if you believe your measurement model, then all of the remaining X's are there as instruments, okay? So we got scads of them. So what we do is we regress X11 on the instruments, and we get X1 hat. Same with X21, get X21 hat. Just illustrating it with two Xi variables. On a shortcut in the second stage, we just regress Y1 on X1 hat and X2 hat. It's equivalent to what I showed you on the other slide, which is a better way of describing it formally. And that gives you the estimates beta 1 hat and beta 2 hat, and they are consistent. Okay? So we got no problem with number of instruments. Well, maybe not quite, but because the bias actually increases as the number of instruments increases, which I found to be quite non-intuitive. Okay? This should be expected value of beta hat minus beta. It's a bias. Right? The bias is proportional to R, 2 in the case that I just played with, the number of latent variables, times P minus 2, which is P is the number of items per scale, number of indicators for each latent variable. I'm assuming it's equal for all of them for now, minus 1. So this actually is the number of three instruments, okay? And as a result, this result is a result due to Nagar in 1959 for single equation, two-stage least squares in econometric models. Now, his definition of instruments was not quite what we have in the Boland type, in the social science type structure, but I did it. It's not hard to show that the result has exactly the same structure when you start off with the typical social science definition of an instrument. The other issue, this is hair-raising to me, finite sample moments may only exist up to degree RP minus 2. In other words, if you don't have any free instruments, you don't have any finite sample moments. I have a hard time with that because, you know, you look at the numbers and everything seems to work out, but there you are. You don't have finite sample moments. Everything works asymptotically, right? Interesting. So there's a bit of a trade-off here, eh? I'm not totally sure. I haven't looked at it, you know, what the manifestation of this will be. You know, the econometricians have looked at it, no doubt. I haven't really spent that much time on that literature. These are the papers that describe some of these results. So there's obviously a trade-off, okay? You want to keep your bias manageable, so you don't want to have too many free parameters, but at the same time, I would like to have a few moments that, you know, can be defined. I'd feel more comfortable if I theoretically got a mean, you know. A brief illustration of that, number of free parameters, number of items, and you can see here the bias, you can see particularly down here how it increases pretty well proportionately to the number of free instruments. More issues. When we're doing single equations, we're not using Y2 to YP. Seems like a waste. It's not totally clear how to pick the best one. Irene and I tried using Bartlett scoring. It results in a conditionally unbiased linear predictor. There may be better methods. In fact, I started working out a way of doing it, working out a linear combination to minimize the ultimate variance. I haven't finished doing that yet. A quick illustration of how it works. Two-stage least squares, two ways, just using Y1 or using the Bartlett one. Really low bias. Two-step, considerably higher. And this is the method from discrete SEM and M+, which is theoretically consistent and so on. Well, as is two-stage least squares. But two-stage least squares sure looks good. Okay. And, of course, remember, it avoids this problem of propagating misspecification error from one equation to another. Now, just a couple of minutes on this one, okay, Richard? Well, you've got to say yes because you're involved in this one. This is joint. See? This is sort of a work group project. This is joint SAMSI NPCDS collaboration. SAMSI operates down there in Research Triangle. And Ken Bolan formed this little group, and we worked on nonlinear problems. So what we did was we looked at the Carl Rupert and Stefanski software that's implemented in Stata. Ken's idea was, hey, maybe we can capitalize on this and bring it into the social sciences, you know, do some good stuff. Well, we read the stuff and we learned what we've heard earlier this afternoon. The Carl Rupert Stefanski methodology, you know, even SIMEX, but certainly their calibration method, it's approximately consistent, which is defined in a formal way. Approximately consistent. The small parameter is the measurement error. Well, in the social sciences, our measurement error is not small, okay? It's not small. You know, the CD for the measurement equation can be 50%, okay? That's not a small parameter. So we gave up on that, and we said, well, let's see if we can use instrumental variables and do better. Turns out we can. So we look at a probit model. We set it up like this, where Y star is continuous. Now, this is unobserved, of course. So this is latent. And zeta here is distributed normally 0, 1. We make that assumption. And this 1, the variance 1, is very important. Okay? And, of course, Y, which is observed, is an indicator function of Y star. Okay? We take the same measurement models, and we get the same unbiased predictors as I showed you for the linear case, and we can get the instruments the same way, or we could get other instruments, but we don't need to. And I'm only just going a quick whip through this. The paper hasn't even been written yet. Ken Boland's writing it, and it's going to be discussed next month at one of the SAMSI NPCDS conferences in November. What we do then is we regress the X's on the Z's to get the X hats. The point with doing that is once you make that substitution of your X hat, you mess up your error term, right? You clutter it up. So the variance is no longer equal to 1. So now your parameters are not consistent anymore, right? They're biased. So we now need to estimate the variance of the disturbance term, and we use, actually it's not a polychoric, I forget what it's called. The name of the routine that I initially used to get it is polychoric. What you're doing is you've got measured binary variables. Underlying that is the Y star, and you've got observed X's, and then you can infer the correlation from the measured binary Y and the measured X, and you can infer the correlation between Y star and X. Okay. Once you do that, you can obtain the bias correction factor, and you can get consistent estimates. And Leachman came up with a closed form expression for this correlation in terms of the data, which then allows to get a linearization estimator really elegantly. So we've got consistent estimates and linearized variance estimates. Prior to that, I'd been using the bootstrap to get them. Okay. The nice thing about this is it gives you consistent estimates and consistent standard errors, not approximately consistent. So we hope to, in fact, you know, import the Carl Rupert Stefanski methodology into social science. In fact, we've done better than that. So now we have to re-export this stuff back into the physical medical sciences it's a nice method. And of course, it can be extended. We haven't done anything on that yet. Just finish very quickly, just to give you an empirical demonstration of the fact that we do get consistent estimates. Three latent predictors, model R squared, so that's really a CD, a half. Three indicators per latent predictor, CD half for each indicator, and then two IVs per latent predictor. Monte Carlo, little Monte Carlo study whipped up one weekend. Sample sizes, three parameters, the model, they're all equal, so what I'm showing here is the mean of the Monte Carlo estimates. And these are the means over, well, first means over the three, and then meaned over the sample size, right? So these are empirical expected values, right? And these are the Monte Carlo standard errors for the beta hats. And then I said, can we detect any bias here? And you can't when you get to a sample size of 1,000. You can prior to that. But you can see how the average value of the regression parameter is, or the average bias, sorry. The average bias is dropping very nicely. And for the intercept, we included intercepts in this. The intercept is undetectable, the bias in the intercept undetectable, even at a sample size of 100. So that's just a little empirical demonstration of the fact that we are getting consistent estimates. That's about what I have. Probably ran over too, did I? Sorry about that.
Or down mean came from